Why are you living in luxurious houses while my house lies in ruins? This is what the Lord of Heaven's armies says. Look at what's happening to you. You've planted much, but you're harvesting little. You eat, but your bellies aren't full. You're not satisfied. You drink, but you're still thirsty. You put on clothes, but you can't keep warm. Your wages disappear as though you were putting them in pockets filled with holes. All this language reflects the very real difficulty they had in trying to raise crops from land that hadn't been plowed in 70 years when they didn't grow up as farmers. It reflects the recession in their economy. It reflects that they had enough to live, but not enough to fill their bellies. He's asking them to consider their living conditions. He said, this is what the Lord of Heaven's army says. Look at what's happening to you. Now go up into the hills and bring down timber and rebuild my house. Then I will take pleasure in it, and then I will be honored, says the Lord. A few verses later, let's see how they responded. What did the people do when the prophet Haggai brought them this message? Then Zerubbabel, son of Shealtiel, and Yeshua, son of Jehozadak, the high priest, and the whole remnant of God's people began to obey the message from the Lord their God. When they heard the words of the prophet whom the Lord their God had sent, the people feared the Lord. Then Haggai said, the Lord's messenger gave the people this message from the Lord. I am with you, says the Lord. So the Lord sparked the enthusiasm of Zerubbabel, son of Shealtiel, governor of Judah, and the enthusiasm of Yeshua, son of Jehozadak, the high priest, and the enthusiasm of the whole remnant of God's people. So I want to ask a couple questions that we'll try and answer together briefly this morning. When the exiles returned, and there's also this story, like you just heard, this story is also recorded in Ezra chapter 1 through 6. In what condition was the city of Jerusalem when they came back? Second question. What were the basic messages Haggai delivered over this? Now, you heard them say 4 months. I believe it's 3 months. It just depends on which calendar you use. They're using more of the English calendar. I was counting it more on the calendar they would have used it that day. Potato, potato, 3 months, 4 months. Doesn't really change the story. But what messages did he give them to lift them out of the depression they were in when they wrote this, when he wrote this letter? And then three application statements at the end. So first question. In what condition was the city of Jerusalem when the exiles returned? Now, you know I'm a history nerd, and sometimes I give you too much history, sometimes not enough. Let me try and get it just right today if I can. You got a little of it in the video. You missed the history, you missed the story. You got to put yourself in the shoes of the people who were there at the time. We're talking about exiles. 587 BC, the very last part of the nation of Israel to fall was the tribe of Judah and the city of Jerusalem. If you remember, after King Solomon, there was a civil war and they split. You had the northern kingdom that formed their own nation. 10 tribes split and made a nation to the north. And then Benjamin and Judah became the nation to the south. They took on the name of Judah. And then up north, you had the northern kingdom of Israel. That northern kingdom fell first. The Assyrians took them first, the tribe of Naphtali, and then the remaining tribes. The Assyrians took them over and conquered them. That left only the southern kingdom of Judah with its capital city of Jerusalem. And then God began dealing with them. If you don't turn, if you don't repent, if you don't get right, if you don't stop doing the things you're doing in sin, the same thing's going to happen to you. And ultimately it did. In 587 BC, it wasn't the Assyrians that took them over. It was the Babylonians. The Babylonians took over Judah. They ransacked and destroyed the city of Jerusalem. And they carried off many or most, but not all, of the citizens of Jerusalem and Judah. Most of them were carried off into Babylon, and that's where they lived. That's where you get the story of Daniel and Shadrach and Meshach and Abednego. That's where some of those stories take place under the Babylonian reign. That was in 587 BC. This story takes place in 520 BC, nearly 70 years later is when we get this story. And now at this time, the Babylonians, just as God said, the Babylonians in that time had been conquered. Another empire raises up. And did you catch the other empire? Who was this empire? The Persians. The Persians are raised up, and now they take over Babylon. And the Persians have a less evil dictator by the name of Cyrus. And under Cyrus's reign, the first thing he does is he opens up the opportunity for anybody who was living in that geographic region as a result of being taken prisoner and captive under the Babylonians. He emancipates them, basically. I mean, they weren't slaves. They were actually allowed to live there. There's more on that in a second. The people who are taken in as as captives that were hauled off in exile, they were allowed to live there, work there, get educated there, become business people, and many of them did. In fact, many of them became so successful in business they didn't want to leave. So Cyrus says, anybody who was captured under the Babylonians is free to go back to your homeland under one condition. The condition is when you go back to the homeland, you build an altar to your God and you promise you're going to pray to your God for me. That's what Cyrus says. So all of the Jews who 70 years previously and all of their children born in captivity, Zerubbabel being one of them. Zerubbabel means, Zeru means seed, Babel means of Babylon, seed of Babylon. So we know he was born in captivity. Yet he was the only living male descendant of the line of David's throne at this time. So critical for bringing Jesus into the world that he is part of this repopulation. I'm going in different directions. So Cyrus says you can go home. In fact, Cyrus even issues them a government subsidy to fund part of their return. And so all of the Israelites are welcome. All of the Jews are welcome to go home. But only 50,000 of them actually go. The overwhelming majority of the Jews remained in Babylon. Because you see, under the Babylonian rule, they were allowed to learn trades. They were allowed to make business. And so Babylon is situated right on the river of the world there. And there was tons of trade coming in and out. And the Jews were very good at learning trades. They were very good at the trade routes. They were very good at buying and selling. They were really good at that. And they generated quick wealth. And many of them became extremely wealthy. And they lived really well in Babylon. And they knew that going back to rebuild Jerusalem, the only attractive part of that was the spiritual part. They were going back to a place where there were no walls. The ground had lied unfarmed for 70 years. There was no river with international trade through routes. And so for many of them, that was just too big of an ask. So the 50,000 people who returned here in this book, their only motivation was a spiritual one. The only thing that drew them to this was they had this dream of rebuilding the altar and building a temple around it and eventually rebuilding the walls of the city of Jerusalem and someday rebuilding a nation that God could call his own again and being part of that. So, you know, the single greatest characteristic of the people who went back, 2 out of every 15 Jews who returned were priests. So a large percentage of the returning people were priests. They were led by two men. Zerubbabel, who we talked about a moment ago, he was from the line of David. He was a prince, or they called him the governor. And then you had Joshua, or Yeshua, interchangeable. Yeshua, same name as Jesus. Yeshua, Joshua, same name, means God saves. So he came back to be the priest. Zerubbabel came back to be the governor and the prince. And they led the 50,000 exiles back home to Israel and Jerusalem. And they knew this was going to be a tough go. They knew that this was going to be really difficult. It was going to be much more difficult in some ways than it was when they were in Babylon. So what was it like when they came back? Well, a couple things. Number one, they came back to a city where there was no temple. There was no altar. Literally, there was no wall left standing. There was no commerce, no business to return to. Everything they did there, they had to eke out, roll up their sleeves, and do it on their own. Agriculture was a big part of the economy of Jerusalem 70 years ago, but if you know anything about farming, if you have soil that has been laid, you know, fallow or whatever, it hasn't been tended to in 70 years, you're not just going to walk back and immediately be able to plant corn and harvest it. There's time, there's work, there's effort, there's conditioning, there's weeding, 70 years of neglect there. Combined with the fact that most of these people didn't grow up as farmers. They lived in Babylon. So they're coming back home to do all of this. All they want to do, the first thing they want to do is just build a simple altar. And then maybe carry some rocks and make some rocks around it, a simple wall around it. But they didn't go back to uninhabited territory. It was less inhabited, but there were people who lived there. If you read through the Old Testament, the story, most but not all of the inhabitants of Jerusalem and Judah were carried off in exile, but a few Jews remained. The Jews who remained, though, made a decision to start marrying outside of their Jewish ethnicity. And so they started marrying non-Jews. And what evolved out of that was a hybrid biracial people called the Samaritans. And the Samaritans did not want these Jews to come back and take that land. And the Jews who came back really looked down on their Jewish, now biracial families and ancestors who stayed there but weren't true to God. And thus began and hatched the hatred, the centuries-long hatred between the Samaritans and the Jews, led to Jesus telling this extremely offensive story 4 centuries later about a Samaritan who was good. Really bothered the Jewish listeners. And so this is what they come back into. And so they set to work, and for the first 2 years, they work really, really hard, these returning exiles. They rebuild a simple altar. They build simple walls around it. They try to eke out a living by working the land and working whatever business that they could. And for 2 years, they focused on rebuilding the altar and trying to work on the temple and also establishing themselves and their families. But after 2 years, they found that it was just too hard. It was really an anticlimactic moment. They were having droughts, famines. The crops weren't as productive as they hoped that they would be. They didn't give the yields that they would. There was so much margin for error and a learning curve for them. They weren't figuring that out all right. They were threadbare. The economy went into a huge recession during that time, and the little money that they had didn't stretch as far. Basic necessities skyrocketed in price. And they made a decision to focus their attention on their own needs, and they stopped prioritizing the finishing of the temple. So after the second year, there was a period then of the next 16 years where they did nothing on the temple. They neglected the Lord's house. So 18 years after they come back, we have this story from Haggai. That's what he enters. He enters to people who came back 18 years ago and were living in a very depressed time. In the very beginning of the chapter, it says the people at some point came to a place where they started naturally asking, why are we having all this trouble? We believed we were coming back here to do a great work for God, to restore the glory of his temple, to restore the glory of our nation. But everything has gone wrong. We can barely eat. We can barely drink. We can barely have clothes. We're working our fingers to the bone. It's been natural disaster. It's been famine. It's been drought. It's been poor crops. And they naturally came to the conclusion. Here's the conclusion they came to. We picked the wrong time to come back and build the temple. This was the wrong time. We should have probably stayed in Babylon a few more years till we could build up enough wealth and really come back in strength. Because you see, Cyrus at this time was no longer the ruler of the Persian Empire. He was succeeded by a man named Darius, and Darius liked to fight wars, and wars were expensive, and so in order to fund his wars, the first thing he did was he cut off the subsidies to all of the returned exiles. So now they don't even have that guaranteed check coming in from the government every month as a backstop to their finances. And they say, this is a result of us choosing the wrong time. And what God shows them is that you've got it completely backwards. The reason you're in this trouble is because you stopped neglecting, or you started neglecting the work of the Lord. You see, what God is essentially saying, it wasn't that you followed my call to start prioritizing my work that put you in this situation. It's when you stopped putting me first financially. It's when you stopped putting me first in your time. It's when you stopped putting me first in your energy and your service, and you started prioritizing yourself over me when you had to make a choice over what came first. If you trace it back, he says, look at what happened and when it happened. You can trace it back to that point. This is my response to your choice to put yourself first. And so that's what they came back to. Second question, what were the basic messages that Haggai delivered over this 3 or 4 month period? Like I said, the people had concluded that it was God who caused their disappointment and that they were suffering and depressed as a result of that. And God says, you've got it backwards. In short, here's what God's telling his people. He says, your thinking has gone wrong. You're looking at a situation and you're thinking deeply about it, but you're thinking incorrectly about it, and your feelings are following your thinking. They were deeply depressed, but they were depressed because they looked at a situation and they thought of it incorrectly. There is such a thing as clinical depression that I understand. And that's medically, you know, when your body's not producing enough serotonin to keep you level. But then there's another type of depression that's the result of bad thinking. You think incorrectly and you think yourself so incorrectly into a depressed state. And what God is telling them is that if you'll rethink, your feelings will follow. So much so that after God helped them to see their situation differently through his lens, it says all of a sudden they were enthused. They had enthusiasm again. So what were the basic messages? In chapter 1, verses 1 through 11, here's the basic message, and it comes in the form of a question. How can you decorate your own house while God's house is devastated? This is a very tough word for us this morning. This is going to be tough. It's tough to hear. Here's what actually was going on. They were in a depressed economy, and we can understand that, and we can have empathy for that. We already know their living conditions were such that they did not have the means to really truly fill their bellies, to really truly satiate their thirst. God's not condemning them for being in a recessed economy. God's not condemning them for having food on the table. God's not condemning them for having clothes. What he goes after, if you read carefully, is they were making an effort to add additional furnishings and DIY home improvements to their houses, which were not necessities, instead of continuing the work on God's house in a depressed economy. What he's showing them is that you're telling me on the one hand you don't have the money or the time to help out in God's house, but you do have enough to import wood to put paneling in your home. And he says, that dishonors me. Doesn't dishonor me that you're having food to eat or clothes to wear. But when you're trying to tell me that you don't have enough money to put me first financially, but you can still have a $99 a month cable plan and a $500 smartphone in your pocket, and you can go to Target and laugh about how you went in there to spend $5 and came out with $50, ha, 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 and then have the nerve to say, but you don't have anything for God's kingdom and you can't keep it first. He's calling them out on their hypocrisy. He's saying, how can it settle in your heart to add luxuries to your life in the middle of a depressed economy when you're not earning what you used to earn? And what he's saying is, when things tightened up, the first thing you stopped doing is prioritizing me with your finances and your time. The first thing. That's the first thing that left. When you were making good money, yes, you'd give. But the moment things tightened up, you wouldn't stop your home improvement projects. You still finished the basement. You still upgraded over here. At the same time, out of the other side of your mouth, you're saying, I can't give. I can't afford to. That's a hard word. But what God is saying is that dishonors me. He uses that word. It dishonors me. And the truth of the matter is, there's some things in all of our lives where money just flows freely without us even thinking about it. Like it leaps out. You go to Disney, Mickey will reach into your pocket around every corner. And some of us say, go ahead, Mickey, go ahead. I'm sitting next to a family at a ball game who has three kids. Every two innings, their kids went up and came back with armloads of pizza, an $11 slushie. It's ice and sugar water. I'm not condemning it. I talked to the dad next to me. I was like, man, it must cost you a fortune. He's like, listen, we just moved here. I was in Cincinnati. He's like, we just moved here a week ago from living in Manhattan. He's like, this is cheap. He's like, I can take them here every night of the week for, you know, economies of scale. And what's the joke? It's just slushies. If I pressed him further, you know where the conversation would go? But it's my kids. I want my kids to have the best. Don't you? You want your kids, your grandkids? You want them to have the best. Nothing wrong with that. For me, I know that's the area of my life where money flows more freely. That's why we have to agree on a limit for what we're going to spend on our kids for Christmas and birthdays. And if I pressed you, you'd say, well, yes, I want, whether it's your kids or some, I want them to have the best. The reason I spend X amount of dollars to put them in these classes, to buy these clothes, to put them in 10 sports, to buy them a $150 baseball bat and cleats, it's because I love them. I love them and I want them to have the best. Well, why do you spend so much money on them? I can't help myself. I just love them. I'll give myself sacrifices. Some of you will say this, and I've said the same thing. I'll put shoes on my kids before I put shoes on myself. Isn't that, you know, what you want to hear? I'll say no. I'll wear the same clothes for years. This is me speaking. So that I can put newer clothes on my kids every 3 or 4 months when they grow out of the old ones. I'll drive 15-year-old cars so I can take my boys on a vacation if I have to choose. You know why? Because I love them. And one of the ways I show that I love them is I give to them. And I give to them without having to wake up every morning and say, you know what? I need to remember, they're my kids. God gave them to me. They deserve to eat today. I don't have to like talk myself. I don't have to rationalize. You know what? Yeah, I'm not going to make my 7-year-old pay his share of the mortgage this month. I'm going to take care of that. I guess he can have seconds on goldfish today. You know, like, it just flows. And so many people, I've heard, and being a pastor for 20 years, I'm not hearing any new reasons as to why people are unwilling to give to church, to the poor. They're all versions of the same thing. I'm not going to preach another teaching series on, you know, combating all of the reasons why you don't give and why you don't want to give. But here's what I do want to ask you. If I pinned some of you down on why you give, what you do to your kids or your grandkids or your this or your hobby or that, here's what it comes down to. I love them, and you can't possibly love somebody without giving. You can't. If you said, I love my kids, and that's why I don't feed them. That's why I don't give money to clothe them. That's why I say no to anything that they want or they need because I love them, makes no sense. That's unloving behavior. Because you see, you can give without loving. I do it every month to BGE. Some of you do it in the offering every week. You give because it makes you feel good and because you think it's buying you credit with God. You don't love them. You just give to make yourself feel good. You can give without loving. You cannot love without giving. And if that's true of your kids, convince me how that's true of your relationship with God then. How can you truly say in your heart, I love you first, but I don't give to you? Or I need someone to convince me and win an argument. He's calling them on the carpet for hypocrisy in their life while they still have something to do about it. And he also said, the reason you're in the state you're in is because I withheld from you the ability to keep getting wealthy because we've been through this dance before with your ancestors. I must be first. I must be first. And he's not saying you shouldn't eat, you shouldn't drink, but he's saying if things are tight, why are you still, you know, watching your DirecTV package is not a necessity, that's a luxury. And how dare you ask other people pay your bills for you when you're throwing hundreds of dollars a month on things you don't need? That's not biblical. And God says to them, how can you sit and feel nothing while you're paneling your home in imported wood? Remember, they don't have wood. They cut all the trees down when the Assyrians came through. They had to import it from Lebanon. How can you have cedar closets while my house is in ruin? It's not because God demanded a fancy temple. He's saying your priorities are out of whack, and it shows up in your checkbook, and all you have to do is walk into your living room and see where your priorities are, is what he's saying. This will make some of you mad. It's okay. I can live with that. The reality is, if you're so convinced that the way you demonstrate your love for your own children, your own family, is in how you give, then define to me your love for God. Explain to me how you can, on the one hand, say, I can't help but give to them because of my love, but I can't get myself to give to God. Oh, but I love him. No, you don't. Not first, anyway. Not more than what your money leaps out to. And until you come to a place where the cross of Jesus Christ impacts your finances, friend, I don't know where you land in terms of lordship. I don't. It's not a condition of salvation, but I'll tell you this. When you understand that he is first, and you really deeply fall into love with him, you don't have to get up every week and give yourselves 10 reasons to write a check to give to God's work. You don't have to muster up the desire to help the poor, help people in your life that need help financially. You will find that it begins to flow almost to the point where you have to get into some of Paul's letters where he had to tell people, you're giving recklessly. You're giving to a point where God's not even asking you to give. Slow yourself down. Paul actually says at some point, you don't have to give to your own deficit. You don't have to give yourself into bankruptcy. But God's saying it's out of priority order. It's out of priority order. That's the message of verses 1 through 11. So let's continue. You're liking this so far, I can tell. Chapter 2, verses 1 through 9. Something else is going on. He gives this message to the people, and here's what I love. The people hear it, and they say, you know what? The prophet's right. Let's change this. And immediately over the next 3.5 weeks, because we get all the timestamps in this book, they mobilize themselves, they get the crews ready, and they start working on the temple again. And it's not really impressive. And some of the old people start to complain. Man, this, you call this a temple? Back in my day, oh, we had a temple. And man, that was demoralizing to the young bucks who were doing the work. They're doing the best they can, and you always get that group that comes by, and, huh, you call this worship? Back in my day, we used to do cartwheels in the altar and wave flags and blow shofars. I collect shofars at the door and tambourines. And you know, like there's one percussionist, he sits up here. Back in the day, we used to blah, 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 blah. And that type of encouragement is not the type of encouragement most of us long for. To be reminded that our very best doesn't measure up to what someone else remembers. And the workers got discouraged and the people got discouraged. So chapter 2, verses 1 through 9, the message from the Lord is, why are you discouraged? Here's the answer. It's because you despise small beginnings. But be strong. Don't be afraid. That's what God says to them. God says to them, all I'm asking for, just put up a little pile of rocks and a wall around it, and then I will be there. And when I'm there, you'll forget all about the design. He says, I'm the differentiator, and I'm not asking you to build me a temple like what you had back in the days of David and Solomon. He says, don't you dare despise small beginnings. Don't you look down at something because it's not as big as what you remember. He says, so don't be afraid, you workers. You be strong. You be encouraged. I put my stamp of approval on it, and who cares what the naysayers say? Man, if God is for you, who cares who's against you, is what he's saying. He's saying what makes this special is not the rocks. It's who hangs out around the rocks. It's not this little wall over here. It's whose presence is there. It's not the party. It's who's at the party. And he's saying, I will be with you. I am with you. So don't you be discouraged. And don't you let people look down on you because you're starting with something small. Those people are missing it. Chapter 2, verses 10 through 18. The people say, why is God not sending the rain? Because here's what was happening. This is crazy. They listen to God. They start giving. They start serving. They keep pushing through. They keep building. And you know what they're expecting? If we do this, if I start tithing or I start giving, checks are going to start rolling in the mailbox. Maybe you don't get checks in the mailbox. My direct deposits from random places are just going to start piling up. Money's just going to start flowing in. I'm going to have to build barns. I don't even, you know, I have a third of an acre, but I'm going to build barns to store it all. And so they start tithing, they start volunteering in the nursery, they start sweeping the floors. When people pick on them, they plug through, and yet, no rain. No big harvests. And they're like, something is broken here. We listen to God, we're doing what he said to do, we're doing all the right actions. He said, sign up for the team, I signed up for the team. He said, serve 4 times a month, I'm serving 6 times a month. I go to church 8 times a week, I added an extra day just to go one more time. They're doing it all. And yet they're not getting the rain. The crops still aren't growing. They're asking all these questions. And then God responds to them through this parable he gives Haggai. He says, if you put dirty and clean things together, do the clean things make the dirty things clean? Or do the dirty things make the clean things dirty? Dirty people with dirty hearts were building a clean temple, and in so doing, they were contaminating it in God's sight. The people thought they were clean because they were building a clean building, a building that was supposed to be holy. They thought they were clean because they were doing the list of things that the prophet said they knew they should do. But God saw it otherwise. The people still weren't putting their hearts right, and they weren't putting their lives right. The people got the message, though, and they immediately started putting their lives right, and the rain started the next day, if you read through the rest of the prophets. And I know if you're like me, you're like, okay, so what was the particular offense? What was the thing that was holding them back? What you see is they were able to do something I don't know you knew was possible. They were able to simultaneously do things the Bible said they were supposed to do and also live in sin at the same time. I don't know if you knew that was possible. They could give offerings while living in complete sin. They could play instruments while having lousy marriages. They could volunteer in the kids' ministry while speaking horribly and being a terrible gossip. They could be the lead teacher and at the same time have a terrible lust problem. I don't know what the sins were. And the beauty of it all is that Haggai didn't have to reveal it. You know why? The people heard the message and they knew right away what he was talking about without him having even to say it. Because they knew better. And maybe that's a word for some of us this morning. To not expect that simply adopting a new set of holy behaviors is automatically going to deodorize and eradicate the sin that's still in your heart. That's a very unhealthy way to view, that's actually a very religious way of viewing things. That says my own works can save me. My own behaviors are what make, listen, there's not enough volunteer hours or money you can give to overcome the sin in our heart. And God said, if I send the rain now, you're going to keep on doing this. You'll work hard on the temple and you'll give, but you'll never deal with the sin in your own heart. And what's actually happening is you're defiling the whole product. You can have a church full with people who volunteer and everything, and if that sin is coming out in every ministry and in every hallway and every foyer and every sermon, when that pride and that ego and that nastiness and that being clicked and all that, when that all comes out, you defile the whole thing. And that's why people walk away from church and say, oh, that was an awful place to be. Lots of people there, but I don't want to be a thing like any of them. God was trying to nip that in the bud. He said, you can't bring your dirty heart into a clean temple and think that your heart's automatically going to get clean because you're doing something that's blessable. And the people heard and they said, you know what? He's right. And they dealt with it. And when you read through the rest of the prophecy, you find the very next day, God sent the rain. Their choice played in. God wanted to send them rain the whole way along. But they were not choosing to align themselves with him, and so he withheld it. And then when they chose to get right with him, he released the rain. You see, our choices do have influence with God. I can't unpack that whole mystery for you. I wish I could fit it into one of two arguments of classic thought, but there's this mysterious way that God has a plan for all of us, and yet within that plan, it delights him to allow our choices to press into that plan. Some way, somehow, as only he knows and understands. And then the last part, chapter 2, verses 20 through 23, you get a preview of the future, which I can't end this week. Pastor James is going to get to talk about next week. You have to keep reading to see what they really did with this and how this really landed. But what God says is, from Zerubbabel, I will continue my royal line. God will overturn other thrones of other nations, and Israel's throne will remain occupied. He says, why? He says, because I've chosen you. And it's interesting, if you study the genealogy of Jesus in the Gospels, one of them traces it, you know, you'll see some that trace up through Joseph's family line and some that trace through Mary's family line. And at a certain point, if you put those genealogies side by side, I can't do justice for this without an illustration. I'll do my best using they're called fingers, apparently. I couldn't think of that word. If you superimpose the two genealogies, you trace Joseph's family line and Mary's family line, at some point they separate. Okay. But then they come back together through one person, and that person is Zerubbabel. That's this guy, the last living descendant to the line of David. And here God says, listen, this is but a taste of the future. There's going to be a time and a place where my kingdom does reign supreme with an ultimate king. And he's going to come from Zerubbabel's line. And who's he talking about? He's talking about Jesus Christ, Yeshua. God saves. And he's reminding them that he still has a big picture that he's trying to fulfill, and that if they choose, they can be part of this picture. Why? Because he loves them. But even more than that, because he's a man of his word. So application, I'll just give you these things real quick, because I think I basically covered these. Application, number one, first things first. Message of Haggai, first things first. And God must always be first. Someone mentioned to me today, they said, yeah, when it comes to this type of a message about putting God first, and we all get passionate about our different causes, but he says, listen, show me your checkbook and your day timer. You know, part of me is thinking, does anybody carry a checkbook, and does anybody know what a day timer is anymore? But he has a point. Now we can take that to a whole point of legalism and say, it's not that. What I'm telling you is when you deeply, deeply, deeply love somebody, they just make their way to the top of the priority list. Don't you want to love God like that? Well, I don't, Pastor. How do I get there? Simple answer. It's simple. I don't mean that to be dismissive. You must know him better, because to know him is to love him. The only reason you don't love God to that level is you just don't know him enough. The more you get to know him, the more you love him. How do I do that? You got to make it intentional. You can know, you have exactly as much of God right now as you want, no more, no less. You want more? You can have it. You want less? You can have that too. But if you want to get on this trail, you got to get to know him better. You got to get to know him better. And then time, energy, resources, you almost have to put barriers to not overgive, to not overserve. First things first. God must always be first. Can I just encourage you not to blow that off today? Well, I don't want to hear this anymore, blah, 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 and go to another church. Okay. At some point, if they walk close to Jesus, you'll hear it again. It's all right. We'll still have church next week. I'm here to disciple you and to help you. I can't make you put God first. I can't force that on you. But I will stand before him one day, and I will give account for what I did with the platform God gave me and the gifts he gave me. This is the platform he's given me. This is the group he sent me to disciple. And the less than 2 times a month you come for 40 minutes. That's what I got. That's what I've got. And if this is the one time you hear me until next month, first things first. And God must always come first. That should show up when we start to worship. I'm really teetering on going on a rant right now, and I'm not going to do that. Number two, our choices matter. Our choices matter. Because I never want to come across from the pastor that you need my stamp of, I'm going to evaluate your worship and your giving, and I'm going to give you the stamp as to what I approve. That's not the position I'm taking. I don't need you to give to please me or worship to please me. But it is one of the ways I'm able to determine where are we as a congregation. Is this a message to Echo Community Church for this particular week in August? We've been asking God to give us a property. Are we ready for it? Have we put God first? Is our worship intense? Is our prayer life where it needs to be? Are our marriages strong and healthy? Are those of us who are living in our singleness, are we honoring the Lord in that? Are we honoring him in our finances? Are we serving? Are we sharing our faith? Are we spending time with him? Are we where we need to be? Are we at a point where God can say yes? Or is this a word for us today? Is this a word for us today, for God to say, listen, those things are in front of you, but first things first. The answer to that question is yes, it is a word for us for today. And before you check yourself off and say, well, I can check off all the boxes, us is the collection of all of the individuals of us. And if even 30% of us are in on something, we're not in as a church. First things first. God must always come first. Second, our choices matter. I've said that multiple times in multiple different ways this morning. We see that God always had good plans for his people, but their choices played a direct part in the timing and the release and whether they received that promise or whether they never saw it. Our choices matter. Your choices matter. Wish I had time to, I'll have to save that story for another week. Number three, healthy feelings grow from healthy thinking, not the other way around. Well, Pastor, I know I'm supposed to do this for God, but it doesn't feel right. It doesn't feel good. I don't get all warm and fuzzy when I do this. Healthy feelings follow. Sometimes we wait to feel good about something before we do it. That's not always how it works. The healthy feelings, I'm not talking about right and wrong feelings. I'm talking about healthy feelings. Healthy feelings flow from healthy thinking. They had some unhealthy thinking. We must have missed God here. Or we chose the wrong time. We shouldn't have done this. And God says, that's not the problem. The problem is that you've gotten me out of order in your life, and that's what's going on here. And they said, oh, we get it now, and they were enthusiastic. Their feelings changed. Healthy feelings grow out of healthy thinking. And the prophets were never afraid to tell the people, think about this. I try really hard on Sundays to get people to think, and I get so much resistance to that. You know, I'll often get people, well, you really made me think today. And you don't mean that as a compliment. It's like an indictment or a rebuke. I didn't come here to think. But God has to challenge our thinking. Because news bulletins, sometimes your thinking is skewed. Not something I'd encourage you to have at the tip of the tongue the next time you get into an argument. Just say, you know what the problem is here? Is your thinking is skewed. Okay, don't necessarily bring that out at the beginning of the argument. It may not go in the direction you're expecting it to go. Before you start telling them all their problems, you come correct to the table. It's also possible and very likely your thinking is skewed. And God doesn't call you to fix their skewed thinking by bypassing your own. You remove the 2x4 from your own eye so that you can take a tweezers and get the splinter out of theirs. I don't want anybody touching my eye that has Home Depot hanging out of their face. I don't want anybody near my eye with that. Healthy feelings grow from healthy thinking, not the other way around. Is God first for you? If he's not, what needs to be done today to move him in that direction of the priority order he needs to be? Where do you need to decrease and where that he can increase? I'd like to pray for you as our worship team comes. Putting God first in your life begins. It doesn't begin with a check. It doesn't begin with volunteerism. It doesn't begin with giving money to a homeless person. Those are all great things to do. But that's not the pathway to putting God first. The pathway is salvation. The pathway is Jesus Christ. That's the only way to God. The only way to God is Jesus and Jesus only. That's it. It's not Jesus and good behavior. It's not Jesus and philanthropy. It's not Jesus and poverty or Jesus and wealth. It's just through Jesus. We're justified freely by putting our faith in Jesus Christ, by his grace. And so some of you need to start there this morning. You need to pray a prayer of confession. Jesus is drawing you to pray that this morning. We call it the ABCs here. It's very simple. Admit, letter A, B, believe, C, choose. We admit that we're sinners and we're broken and we're imperfect and we can't self-repair. We know something's broken in us, and that explains it. We've been living our life as our own God, doing what pleases us, what brings us satisfaction, right and wrong as we determine it. We admit that to God. We admit the wrongness of that. Then we confess our belief in Jesus Christ, his Son, that Jesus lived a sinless life that we should have lived, that he died a death on the cross that we deserve to die, that we talked about this morning. And in so doing, his purity was imparted to us, and our dirtiness fell on him. And when he rose from the dead and is alive today, that he defeated death, and that because he rose again, we have hope to believe that we can rise again too. And then see, you choose. This is what we talked about, the first things first. That's lordship. First things first means lordship. He comes first in everything. In priority order. It's not always the amount. It's the order. He comes first. That's what we bring to the table to start a relationship with Jesus. So if you want to make that your commitment today, you can pray a simple prayer that says, Jesus, I admit that I've sinned. I've been living life my own way, and I'm deeply sorry, and I regret that. I confess to you my belief in you, Jesus, that you're God's Son. You lived a sinless life. You died on the cross in my place. You rose from the dead. I accept forgiveness for my sins. And I invite all of you to come and live in me. And I choose to place you first as my Lord. First things first, and you'll always come first. In your name I pray. Heavenly Father, I pray for us as a church family. Deal with our hearts. Deal with our hearts. Because we know you have good plans for all of us individually, within our families, within our businesses, and with us as a church family. We recognize that many times along the way, we could be the ones standing in the way of you moving us forward. because something's not right. So, Lord, rather than looking down our row and praying for that person to get right, we look in our hearts and say, God, help me to be right and to live right. And where things are out of order in my life, make it clear to me, and then give me the courage, the discipline, the boldness, the humility to make course corrections, because I want to enjoy the life you've intended me to have. In your mighty name I pray. Amen.